Welcome to 3 o'clock docket at the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofano. And you are our only case on the 3 o'clock docket that's set for oral submission. So understand both sides are ready? And if you call the case, we'll get started.
May it please the court, my name is Wes Davis. I'm here on behalf of appellants Nexion Health at North Richland Hills and Nexion Management, Inc. This case involves and allegations under Chapter 74 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code for alleged negligent care of a man named Mr. Alvia Bledsoe while he was a resident at Green Valley Healthcare and Rehabilitation Center in approximately 2012. Appellee alleges that Mr. Bledsoe developed pressure ulcers, bacteria, and infections while residing at the Green Valley Nursing Facility, which ultimately resulted in Mr. Bledsoe's death in June 2012. The appellee served an expert report from Dr. Lige Rushing, which appellants moved to dismiss in the trial court. The motion to dismiss was denied in January. On this interlocutory appeal, we have three issues. The first one is a lack of adequate opinion on causation. The second is a lack of a report addressing appellant, Nexion Health Management, Inc. And the third is, if insufficient, should the case be remanded to the trial court for a potential 30-day extension of time to cure the report. On the first issue, lack of causation, there are two subparts to that. The first is the dates in the expert report that Mr. Bledsoe actually resided at the facility and the date that he was discharged from the facility. The second issue is the lack of the report's inclusion of a cause of death or an explanation of a causal link from the alleged negligence to the actual death. On the first issue, it really boils down simply to there's conflicting explanation in the expert report as to when the Mr. Bledsoe was actually discharged from the facility. At one point, it states that Mr. Bledsoe resided at the facility from September 2011 until June 9th, 2012. However, in a separate portion, he states that Mr. Bledsoe was discharged from the facility on April 29th, 2012. And the issue with that is that Mr. Bledsoe died outside of the facility on June 15th, 2012. And the reason why we assert that there's no causation or inadequate causation on that issue is because we cannot tell when or where these alleged injuries occurred. And the real reason that that's an issue with this case is the injuries that Dr. Rushing explains in his report are pressure ulcers, pneumonia, development of bacteria. They're injuries that you would incur as a result of a pattern or a treatment over time that would result in these conditions, such as with the pressure ulcers, for example. The allegation is that the patient wasn't moved frequently enough. Pneumonia is just failure to monitor the patient, bacteria, failure to monitor. So if we don't know whether Mr. Bledsoe was residing at the facility from April 29th, 2012 through June 9th, 2012, we don't know whether it was actually the appellant's actions that caused these injuries at issue.
Or rather, lack of action?
Exactly, yes. That's the issue, and I think it's particularly relevant to this case where it's not an issue of somebody falling and breaking their leg or you know, a heart attack or some issue like that. It's the timeliness and the occurrences over time are the issue in the case. And the issue here is that we don't know what occurred over those periods. Adding to that is that there's no other dates in the report. If, for instance, Dr. Rushing had said, I notice on, June 1st, 2012, there's a note in the nursing reports from Green Valley stating that today we turned Mr. Bledsoe and he was fine. That's not in there, so there's no way for us to validate when or where these injuries could have occurred. If Dr. Rushing had incorporated a more detailed description, I think we might have been able to come to an explanation of what happened, but that simply is not here, and it's not
in the... You're saying their whole case has to be in that affidavit?
No, not at all, Your Honor. I'm saying that I think it actually could have been, if there was any way to verify where the patient was during the times in question, between April 29th, 2012 and June 9th, 2012, you wouldn't have to explain the whole case, and you wouldn't even really have to explain a lot of the case. I think if you could even have one other date in there that could maybe verify where the patient was at that time. But the report doesn't have that, and the complaint contains the same discrepancy and also doesn't have any explanation of where Mr. Bledsoe was during this time. So that's why we think that it's
Did
not
Did anybody
like,
say he was transferred from there to the hospital?
Yes, it said that he was transferred from there to the hospital on April 29th and on June 9th, two different times. So it's unclear where he was between April 29th and June 9th. That is the issue. Basically, the problem is it requires the court to, the language used in all these cases is you can't make an inference into causation, an inference into what the expert report says if it doesn't actually say it. And the problem is with the discrepancy in the dates, it doesn't require just an inference, it requires a guess. It requires us to guess where Mr. Bledsoe was from April 29th, 2012 to June 9th, 2012, or to just assume that he was at Green Valley when neither the complaint nor the expert report actually includes that allegation. On the second issue, with the report is, as far as causation goes, is the cause of death. Dr. Rushing identifies Mr. Bledsoe's death certificate as a document that he reviewed, but doesn't explain what the cause of death was or how the alleged injuries to Mr. Bledsoe led to the cause of death. And we cited a case in our briefing, Granberry v. Hossack, out of the 10th Court of Appeals, where it found Dr. Rushing's report insufficient for actually identifying the cause of death, which was a cardiac arrest, but then failing to link, I believe it was a broken leg, to how the cardiac arrest would result from that injury. And here we have even less information. And there's actually a recent case in April out of the 5th Court of Appeals, which we had not yet cited in our briefs, and it was also a Dr. Rushing report, and it addressed a report where he did not include the cause of death despite reviewing the certificate of merit. And that case was Texas Health v. Frausto, F-R-A-U-S-T-O, and it's not published yet. It's case number 05-14-00895. And in that case, they believe that he covered a number of the issues required for the report addressing standard of care.
So is that really relevant to this case? I mean, aren't we talking about the particular report at issue here and reports he's filed in other cases? Are they really relevant?
I think so. And the reason I do agree that you shouldn't always just say, hey, his report got overturned in this case, in another case, so you guys shouldn't look at his report. But here, why I think it's important is that there are a lot of, I think, people trying to find what are required for these reports and what is a concrete thing that has to be in a report and what doesn't. And I'm not saying a death certificate or a particular cause of death is a particular thing that has to be in a report. I'm not saying that's a rule that is in every case. But I think this case out of the Fifth Court is illustrative of the way that Dr. Rushing's report in this case and that case, and in the Tenth Court of Appeals that I cited, does not get to the causation between the death and the injuries alleged. And that's, it's particularly important in these nursing home cases because a lot of times there are intervening places where the patient goes, and there's intervening treatment. So you're talking about, on top of the fact that nursing staff are not doctors, and it's a different standard of care, so you're talking about, just like this case, a case where you've got someone with pressure ulcers, and you're trying to say that pressure ulcers led to this patient's death, and not even just the pressure ulcers led to that, but that the nursing staff did something to exacerbate pressure ulcers or to create pressure ulcers that created a life-threatening condition. So when you're talking about, you know, Mr. Bledsoe left the facility, whether it's April 29th or June 9th, whatever time it may be, you need to explain how what happened at the facility caused someone to die. I think it's different where you're talking about maybe a car wreck accident and someone goes to the hospital and you allege that the anesthesiologist, you know, improperly put, you know, did anesthesiology resulting in death to the patient. There's less of a, I guess, tenuous connection there. And here, I think it shows in each of these cases with Dr. Rushing, not quite a connection to a cause of death. And in this particular case and the case in the Fifth Court of Appeals, not only not a connection, but not even an explanation of what the cause of death was.
So you want us to give them a go-by?
What do you mean by that, Your Honor?
Suggest a form affidavit.
Oh,
what
no, that's...
include, so...
Not at all, Your Honor. I think there are other ways to do it, including he also reviewed the hospital records in this case. He's got them as records that he reviewed. I think he could very easily say, I reviewed the hospital records and the records after Mr. Bledsoe was transferred to the hospital, they showed this, this, and this. Those were conditions that Mr. Bledsoe first accrued while he was at the nursing facility. Those conditions continued while he was at the hospital. The reason that those conditions were as severe as they were was because of the conduct by the nursing facility. And, you know, subject to my review of the medical records, that's what led to Mr. Bledsoe's death. He doesn't do that either here. So I guess talking about the cause of death is probably just an easy way to show this lack of causation. It's an easy way to really get to the heart of he's not explaining what needs to be explained here. But there, as I said before, I'm not trying to advocate for a form affidavit or for a list of things that have to be included. I think what the case is and what the statute says, and I think this is much more preferable than a form affidavit, is you need to explain step by step how the conduct that you're complaining of led to the injuries, led to the death that actually happened. And to me, the lack of the cause of death is just an indicator and a major red flag that that type of information isn't in there. Could he have done it another way? Yes, but he didn't in this case. It's just simply not there. The second issue we have is with respect to Nexion Health Management itself. And we objected and have appealed based on the fact that Nexion Health Management was not addressed at all by Dr. Rushing's report. And the response to that argument was that, citing certified EMS v. POTS, which states that a claim of vicarious liability, when there is a claim of vicarious liability and there's a valid expert report addressing the underlying claim, meaning the employee's actions or the agent's actions, then the vicariously liable party does not need to be addressed by the report. Basically stating that adequately states one cause of action against that party, all causes of action can go forward. I don't disagree with that finding. It's Texas Supreme Court and it's pretty clear. I think the issue in this case is that there's no vicarious liability allegation. the allegations in the complaint, and it's on court record 5, it states Nexion Health at North Richland Hills and Nexion Health Management both, and this is separately, this is not as the same one, own, operated, supervise, and or staff the nursing facility. Then the report refers to Green Valley Healthcare and Rehabilitation and its staff, goes on to describe the allegations in the report. There is, other than that statement, there is no explanation in the complaint about vicarious liability, about Nexion Health Management being responsible for Nexion Health at North Richland Hills, about either of them being vicariously liable for the staff.
Wouldn't you have to file some special exceptions then?
I thought of that, Your Honor, and we actually discussed that before the case or before this appeal, but after the motion to dismiss. And my explanation for that is I'm not sure how we would file special exceptions when we didn't know that there was – this isn't a case of you didn't state a claim against this client, against this particular entity or insufficient pleading. It's just something that's not in there. So there's not really a way to know that – well, when you object to this expert report, then they're going to claim that there's a vicarious liability allegation that was not actually in the complaint. So I don't think there was any way for us to anticipate that with a special exception. I see my time is up. If
are
you
there
don't.
Any questions?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh. I just received an email not long ago that we are no longer under threat of a false fire alarm going off. So I had announced that during the 1:30 docket. So
may it please the court. I think that one of the most important things to point out at the beginning is that even though appellant would like to add all kinds of different requirements as to what an expert report should include, that's just simply not the law. An expert report need only to provide a fair summary of the standard of care, explain how that the defendants failed to meet the standard of care, and a causal connection to that conduct. And there must only be a good faith effort to do that. The Supreme Court in Certified EMS versus Potts has articulated what a good faith effort means. Specifically, all we are required to do when we file an expert report at the very beginning of a lawsuit, when likely there are very few records and there hasn't been any discovery yet, no depositions, no testimony, no policies and procedures from the hospital, all we have to do is inform the defendant of the conduct that the plaintiff has called into question and provide a basis for the trial court to rule that the cause has merit. That is all that is required. Because as soon as we point to the various allegations or issues that are inappropriate and allegedly negligent within the records that are available, then the defendant can go and seek out evidence, just like we can go out and seek evidence. I think a very important quote was made in Scoresby, which is at 346 Southwest 3rd, 546. It's a 2011 case. In Scorsese, the court noted that the purpose of the MLA expert report requirement is to deter frivolous claims. It's not to dispose of claims regardless of their merit. It must be remembered that there are constitutional limitations upon the power of courts to discuss an action or to dismiss an action without affording a party an opportunity for a hearing on the merits of his cause. Now, the trial court in this case certainly did not abuse his discretion or its discretion when he relied on relevant case law to interpret a correct ruling on causation and vicarious liability. Under an abuse of discretion, you would have to find that the trial court clearly failed to analyze or apply the law correctly, or that the court acted in an arbitrary or unreasonable manner and did not apply the rules and principles present. That's clearly not the case. As to the issue of causation, Dr. Rushing, and what I'd like to just address briefly is the issue with the dates. The report is very clear as to the dates and when these injuries occurred. There is not a discrepancy, as defendant would have this court believe. On page 72 of the record, which is the expert report, there is a reference to when Mr. Bledsoe was at the facility, and then it says on or about April 29th, 2012, Mr. Bledsoe was transferred to Texas Health Harris HEB after experiencing altered mental state. Okay, that is the date that he was transferred to the facility or to the hospital, and it was noted all of his injuries. So the court has enough information to determine when it was first noticed that these injuries occurred. And certainly Dr. Rushing reviewed the records that were available. We don't know whether or not that's all the records because we haven't started conducting discovery yet. It stayed in the interim of this report requirement and the appeal. He notes that upon admission to the hospital directly from the nursing facility, it was discovered that he, Mr. Bledsoe, was suffering from an unstageable pressure ulcer on his left hip, a stage one pressure ulcer on his coccyx, a stage one pressure ulcer on his right lateral hip, a deep tissue injury to his right heel, severe urinary tract infections, pneumonia, malnutrition, bronchitis, and acute renal failure. That happened, and that is noted exactly when he went from the facility, defendant's facility, to the hospital. Then Dr. Rushing goes on to tell us how this likely occurred given the records that he reviewed. And he certainly provides a causal link between what the defendants did wrong and the resulting injuries as noted by the hospital. Dr. Rushing talks about that the defendants, first of all, he says, there is no notice or no notation upon admission to the facility that there were any pressure ulcers or any conditions that were found subsequently when he had to be rushed emergently to the hospital. Right? He was fine when he was admitted. Then, while he's admitted, under the care of defendants, he is under the care and required to have a certain level of care so that he does not develop pressure ulcers. Dr. Rushing talks about what the standard of care requires. Talks about that there should be a pressure ulcer prevention program. He talks about how there should be turnings and skin assessment. He talks about how there is no indication in the records of any consistency as to when the defendants are doing all of the things that they're required to do to prevent these injuries. Then he goes on to explain how the failure to provide this protocol, this pressure ulcer protocol, and document any kind of changes in skin conditions resulted in the decline to Mr. Bledsoe's health and demise. There are two pages of causation analysis, single-spaced, where, Dr. Rushing talks about how a pressure ulcer ends up creating the type of infection that causes death. He says, when the tissues are deprived of blood flow, oxygen, and nutrients, then the death of tissue occurs. The medical term for this is necrosis, and in layman's terms, the tissue simply dies and decays. This is precisely what happened in this case. Unrelieved pressure on a capillary is just like placing one's foot on a garden hose, compressing it. and shutting off the flow. And he goes on and on to explain exactly how this failure of the defendant's agents, their nurses, their techs, their failure to provide a protocol to take care of him led to these multiple pressure ulcers. So certainly when the defendant claims that this is conclusory, the report is conclusory, is very distinguishable from some of the other cases relied upon. And I think it's important to note that there are cases where Dr. Rushing's reports were found to be absolutely sufficient on the issues. One of those cases that is, I think, it has a very good recitation of what's required and the importance of whether or not a cause of death is necessary would be Nexion versus Taylor. That's 294 Southwest 3rd 787. That's a 2009 case, and the court artfully points out that the issue is not whether the expert identified a specific disease or condition that caused the death. It is whether the report has an accurate representation of the causal relationship between the defendant's alleged failures in the standard of care and death. And the court goes on to note that there is, even where there's no notice of the precise cause of death, the report may be held sufficient. So, and the injury sustained in this case, which this is a little bit of a tangential issue, because we only need to establish one theory of liability, meaning there were injuries caused from the defendant's conduct. In that case, if there are any injuries caused by the defendant's conduct, then that's sufficient for this case to move forward onto discovery. That's enough to demonstrate that this case has merit. So even if, let's say even if the report doesn't say that the defendant's conduct caused death, there's certainly enough evidence in the record that the defendant's conduct caused injury, pressure ulcers, malnutrition, dehydration, all of the aspects that are addressed there. Now I'd like to address the issue of vicarious liability. In appellant's reply brief, they cited to the Ortiz case. And coincidentally, even though the Ortiz case holds that the causation element was not properly met in that case, it does point out a very clear, bright line rule as to what is required for an expert report when vicarious liability is alleged. In fact, the case provides that when there is a vicarious liability claim that implicates the agent's conduct, then that is sufficient. The report need not state that parent company or other defendant's conduct as long as the agent's conduct is implicated. And in Ortiz, I think at footnote 4, that would be very helpful for this court to review, because in footnote 4 of Ortiz, the court lays out what the allegations were in the petition, because similarly in Ortiz, the defendants argued, well, the petition doesn't say vicarious liability, so that doesn't work here. Well, the allegations in the petition in Ortiz, I would say, are much less precise than the allegations in our case. And even though, as Justice Walker pointed out, the proper challenge to that, any defect in the pleading, would be filing a special exceptions, defendant certainly could have done that, because unlike the recitation of the facts a little bit earlier by appellant, there are many allegations against all of the defendants that implicate the nurse's misconduct in this case. It's just not merely at the second page of the petition. Specifically, if the court would look at page 8 of the record, the medical negligence provision, it says defendants, and defendants are well laid out within the first provisions of the complaint. Defendants are health care providers licensed by the state of Texas to provide health care. Defendants owe the decedent a duty of care to exercise that degree of care required by the decedent's known mental and physical conditions, which duty of care these defendants breached by the acts and omissions of negligence by defendants and their agents, employees, and representatives, including the following. And then we go and we list different subsets as to how those agents breached the standard of care. One was failing to observe, intervene, and care for the deceased, neglecting the deceased to such a degree that she suffered illness and death, failing to provide the medical and nursing care reasonably required for the deceased's known conditions, failing to provide the appropriate supervision and training to its staff and personnel that were providing care to the decedent, including appropriate care related to Mr. Bledsoe's tracheotomy. So it goes on and on as to how defendant, the parent company, the Nexion Incorporated's agents, caused injury and damages to Mr. Bledsoe and his family. There's one other case that we didn't cite in our brief that I think is important on this issue. This is the TTHR Limited case, which is also a Supreme Court case. It came out right on the heels of Certified EMS, and that is 401 Southwest 3rd 41. 401 Southwest 3rd 41. And this case also indicates that as long as one theory of liability is included and the conduct implicated is of the agents, then the report is sufficient to move it past the stage of the preliminary expert report. Finally, if this court is willing to reverse the trial court and find that the trial court abused its discretion in finding this report sufficient, we believe under Scoresby we should have 30 days to cure. As set forth in Scoresby, the court should err on the side of granting an extension, and it states must grant if it appears that the report is curable, and or the deficiencies in the report are curable. I see my time is up.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Wes, do you have a rebuttal?
I just quickly wanted to address the statements on page 72 of the record regarding the dates and the issue, as I stated before, she cited to on or about April 29th, 2012, Mr. Bledsoe is transferred to Harris, Texas Health Harris, HEB, stating that's when the injuries were noticed, and this is what the report is based on. And I think what the inference is that then he went back to the facility after that, but the problem that the report has is that right before that paragraph, it states that he was a resident at Green Valley from on or about September 3rd, 2011 until June 9th, 2012. So the issue is just, did he go from the facility to the hospital, back to the facility, back to the hospital? I don't think he did, and it's not stated in this report. So if he stayed at the hospital or if he was transferred to a different facility, what was the treatment there? Was that a contributing factor or not to Mr. Bledsoe's death, which didn't occur until June 15th, 2012? And the reason it makes the report conclusory is because failing to link those actions is a conclusion that is not supported by the rest of the facts in the report. It appears that basically Dr. Rushing reviewed, I can't even tell exactly what he reviewed to get to these dates. I think it may have been the complaint. It may have been the hospital records, I'm not sure. But if he could simply explain, you know, where the issue is, where Mr. Bledsoe was in those intervening months, and simply explain these were the injuries that, which were not cured over the intervening months when he resided at X, that would connect the causal chain. That would get you to, here's how we got the injuries, here's how we got to the death. The way the report is right now, it simply doesn't explain that issue. And I think without that issue, you can't get to the end. The second part I wanted to address was just about deterrence of frivolous claims and the abuse of discretion standard. And I think in particular with this report, the problem, and this is what many of the cases say, is that you have to infer what the doctor is trying to say. And it may or may not be a frivolous claim. It may or may not be a good faith report. But the problem is, with the lack of information, with the dearth of explanation in this report, we can't tell. And that's the purpose of the rule, is to make sure that claims that are brought have merit. And without connecting these injuries to the ultimate result, which also includes getting to the cause of death, is what I want to call it, because it's correct that the cause of death, there's not a checkbox you have to hit and have the cause of death or the death certificate in the report. But in this case, and I think a good opinion on this that we cited in our brief that this court issued was Kalini v. Pustajovsky. It was in 2009. And it's a different issue, but I think it's illustrative because it talks about how the injury alleged was tardive dyskinesia. And I don't believe this was a death case. There was an alleged negligence, and it resulted in this particular condition. And I think that makes a lot of sense when you talk about death, because it's easy for an expert to say this condition led to death. And then that's it. Well, more is required than that.
Does the petition say caused the death or caused injury?
It's both, I believe, Your Honor. Are you talking about?
So if the affidavit talks about causing injury, then how is that deficient as to injury?
Well, we can go into the injuries, causation of the injuries. What would you like me to get through that portion?
Well, I'm looking at the conduct of defendant in this case that is called and questioned is outlined above. It is my opinion that the events and failures set forth in this report proximately caused Mr. Bledsoe's injuries. Sounds pretty clear to me.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that not clear?
The way that it's not clear on the injuries is that we can't tell where he was during the time period we discussed. So April 29th, 2012 through June 9th, 2012. That's the way that it's not clear on the injuries. If you're reviewing hospital records and you're saying these are the injuries and this is what led to the death, there's a causal disconnect between what caused the injuries when you find him at the hospital, if you don't know what dates he was at the hospital or at the facility.
Any other questions?
Mr. Davis, the report from Dr. Rushing says he looked at the death certificate. You looked at the death certificate?
I have not, Your Honor. I do know what's
where he was when he died?
Yes, he was at a hospital. I'm not sure if it was Texas Health HEB or not.
But he wasn't at Green Valley facility.
And I can no, he wasn't. And I can tell you, although it's not something, you know, you're only supposed to go by the four corners of the complaint and by the four corners of the expert report, the cause of death in the death certificate that we have was pneumonia. So, you know, in particular, when you're talking about pressure ulcers and how are you getting to these things, that it's kind of hard. It kind of goes back to what I was saying a minute ago. When you just say it led to death, it's very easy to just get to that conclusion. But when you have an actual cause of death, or you have, as I said with the Collini case, some kind of injury that you know you're trying to get to, then you can say, well, did he explain this properly? Did he get to this this cause, and did the causation connection come together? And that's the problem with him not including that information. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted.
Much.
You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.